Today on Political Rewind, we're joined by Georgia Congressman Doug Collins. We'll ask him what the delay in approving emergency relief funds for Georgia farmers tells us about dysfunction in Washington, about the president's stonewalling of efforts to have administration officials testify on Capitol Hill, and his role in promoting border security, plus much more. Political Rewind starts now. It's great to have you here for Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nygut. Let's get right to work on this show. Jim Galloway is with me, of course. He's the lead political reporter for lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the paper, and you continue to oversee the Political Insider blog, which is part of AJC.com. And you're from Britain. From Britain.
Yes, I left, Donald Trump came. It was an even swap.
Yeah, and as I asked you right before the show, you have not brought back with you, as some Americans do, a British accent.
No, I left it there.
Yeah,
it
was, good for you. We're very happy that we're joined today by 9th District Congressman Doug Collins, who has, as we said in the opening of the show, you've really become a very hot commodity up there. You're in the national spotlight more than ever. At least in part because of your work on the House Judiciary Committee. But just to make sure people know where you are, you've got, in the 9th, you've got Hall County, you've got Dawson County.
We got 20 counties in Northeast Georgia. For the old historians in Georgia, it goes back to the old 9th district of Phil Landrum, Ed Jenkins, you know, coming through Nathan Deal as we go forward. So I stretch from Elberton all the way over to Fannin and down to Forsyth, part of Athens-Clarke, and then everything up. So it's a beautiful part.
Third term in the U.S. House?
Just started my fourth.
Started
my fourth.
Okay. And already has to run for re-election.
Just started my fourth, running again.
We do want to talk about the role that you're now playing as the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. And there's some news that we can talk about, which we've just gotten to see as we're getting set for this show today. But just to give people a little bit of the taste of the way you have worked to, in some ways, protect the president, but to make sure the Republican voice is heard on the Judiciary Committee. Let's just play a little bit of you in one recent session of the committee.
Okay.
We now have the reason for this hearing. It has nothing to do with the oversight of DOJ. It has everything to do, as we found out this morning in a document dump from the Democratic side of this committee and also another committee, that this is nothing more than a character assassination. And we're going to also decide to see if we can just do something and get at the president while we're had the chance. We're going to have plenty of theatrics. Bring your popcorn. I'm thinking about maybe we just set up a popcorn machine in the back, because that's what this is becoming. It's becoming a show.
So, Congressman, I don't want to get into the specifics of what you were addressing at that moment, but I think it's a fair representation of the way you've felt you need to present yourself and deal with what's happening in your concerns about judiciary. And you made a statement today in which you essentially have said that you believe the Judiciary Committee is on a collision course with the rules of the House. Explain what that means.
Well, it's good to be here, and I think one of the things I want to explain is sometimes you have these issues, and the roles that we play is making sure that there's fairness and there's hearings, and especially when you delve off into areas that we have seen on the investigation side, and say, let's have a fairness here. If you want to investigate, that's fine. We'll do that, but it's got to be in a process in which we're not leading people to have a false impression of what's going on. Up until this point, my chairman, Chairman Jerry Nadler, has tried to do everything he can to appear as if he's impeaching or attempting to impeach the president. He does this in the way he sets up his hearings, what they've called it, how they sort of went about saying the witnesses they want. Next week, we're having a hearing, and this is where it really gets interesting with the rule. We can say anything we want to here, you know, sort of about if we thought about somebody. But when you're in the House, to keep a decorum, you have to go back to the old Jefferson Manual, the parliamentary rules. This says when we debate, and I have people talk to me about this all the time, they say, well, how can you say my good friend across the aisle or my colleague? Well, that's part of the language that we use to get across our points. What you cannot do is besmirch, demean, attempt motive to say someone did something that they can't. And that's including the President of the United States. So next week, we're having a hearing in which John Dean, the former from the Watergate era, and others are going to be there. And they're taking the Mueller investigation in the second part. And the whole basis, even the title of the hearing, implies that the president committed obstruction. What we're reminding the chairman is it in no way under the rules of the House, unless you open an impeachment inquiry, can you say that the president actually committed obstruction or imply witnesses to say that the president broke the law and did something for political gain. So this is where it's becoming not only a concern. Chairman Nadler knows what to do. He also knows the American people are not behind that. And so between him and the speaker and others, they're having to try this dance. And we're just reminding him, Mr. Chairman, you got the votes. You can do what you want to in this committee, but you're also going to do it by the rules.
There's really a couple of committees where we're watching the headbutting, the real problems with comedy, with getting on the same page play out. One of them oversight, the other Judiciary Committee. At one point in a Judiciary Committee hearing, you repeated a refrain that we hear from Republicans, which is no collusion. Mm-hmm. The Mueller report really didn't find, wasn't even looking at actual collusion, but we'll let that go.
That's not a crime.
So. Right. And no obstruction. Mm-hmm. But the Mueller report didn't say no obstruction. It said if we thought the president hadn't committed a crime, we would have said so.
Well, it's interesting. When did Bob Mueller become the you're guilty to I have to prove you innocent? That's the whole anathema to our political system, and really one when he went out last week and gave his Comey-esque statement. Here's all the problems I see, but in the end, we didn't do anything. I think what we've got to understand here is there was, let's don't overlook the collusion part, which is they said collusion. That's for 2 years, the Democrats all talk collusion. Conspiracy, they didn't go to the actual crimes, but the collusion. At the end of the day, it was a complete exoneration on the collusion part, which was the overriding discussion of most everybody going into the Mueller report. Obstruction and discussions of that came in later.
Collusion on whose part?
The Trump administration's part.
We did have the president, we did have the chairman of the president's campaign meet with a Russian fellow with intelligence contacts and hand him data from the Trump campaign.
And Bob Mueller actually showed that in the report, and
we did that.
And also the prosecutor.
So somebody was colluding with somebody.
Well, I think the passing on, again, it goes into this issue of what is colluding and what it, does it rise to the criminal activity level that the conspiracy or other things was going to. And Mueller complete, that's the one aspect that even Democratic friends say, well, we're done with that. You know, they still like to point to it. I mean, we had one of our chairmen of our committees, Adam Schiff, say, it's collusion in plain sight. This was before the report came out. Again, attesting things that were not there. But on the other side, back to the other issues in this, it was a very, the second part of the Mueller report was 98.9% unredacted, and I've seen the little bit of the what's left. So it's very much out there. The president allowed his staff to be interviewed. We see this in the report. But I want to make it clear. When Mueller comes out and makes his pronouncement, and he says, well, if there was something there, we would have said so. Well, again, in the whole judicial network, there's never a time when our prosecutors are supposed to start from that you're guilty and I'm going to find you innocent. It is the presumption in our system that you're innocent until we find something. Now, he said that he relied on an OLC opinion. That was his statement from last week. But I want to take it a step further.
Office of Legal Counsel.
Office of Legal Counsel.
Just
I apologize.
So people know.
Office of Legal Counsel. But when it went to Bill Barr and Rod Rosenstein, which we was both in this. Rod Rosenstein was an Obama appointee. Bill Barr came in, of course, just recently. They made it very clear in their statement they did not take in any opinions or anything else when they took the report from Mueller and then made their own legal analysis of will we charge or not. So, again, we're getting into a point now to where, frankly, the report speaks for itself. I will agree with Bob Mueller about that. The report speaks for itself. The question is, though, it didn't say what the Democrats wanted it to say because they had been promising for 2 years that when this report comes out, it'll all be solved. We'll be there. So I think that's where we're at this point.
Let me ask you, you're the ranking Republican on Judy, and just as an outside the leadership of the House there, how much of what we're seeing from Jerry Nadler is as far as beginning to emphasize the impeachment aspect, is this an attempt by Nadler and other Republicans or other Democrats to consolidate all these investigations under one unit?
Yes. I believe it is. And I think what you're seeing is there's been a, again, they were out, this is interesting dynamic to play out. They were out of power for 8 years. They came back in, and many of these chairmen had been waiting for a long time to be chairman, and then all of a sudden this sort of got thrown in their lap, so to speak, with the 2016 election. Most of them thought it would have been Hillary Clinton and that they were trying to win it back. So they, Speaker Pelosi came up with this plan, and this has been really interesting. They said, we're going to coordinate all of our investigations. So they had foreign affairs, oversight, ways and means, intel. And it's really been a disaster. If you look at the last 5 months, they've accomplished virtually anything that would become law to further agenda, and the investigations have went nowhere. I'll use an example, and that's why I think Chairman Nadler is trying to consolidate. When they held Bill Barr in contempt, we pointed out the fact that it was way too early, way too quick, you did nothing right here, and in court you'll lose. The next week they came in and they said, well, we're going to do a hearing to sort of firm up from last week on executive privilege. My witness, Jonathan Turley, and then the other three witnesses, which were called by the Democrats, were asked a question by myself and by Kelly Armstrong from North Dakota and said, is the subpoena that Chairman Nadler gave to Bill Barr asking for grand jury information, basically asking him to do something illegal? Every person on that panel said yes, they've asked for something illegal. So I think they're struggling with this. Nadler is now saying, I've got a lot on my committee. I got a lot of Democrats who want to start an impeachment inquiry. So they can sit on that dais and say the president committed a crime. And I think that's why they're trying to consolidate it.
So I think the American people, like members of Congress, will look at whatever portions or the entire Mueller report that they want to, and they'll draw their own conclusions about this, and obviously people are going to have different opinions. But here's something I think is really interesting in terms of you. As you said, this thing all began with a look at, was Russia interfering with the presidential election on behalf of President Trump? And was there some cooperation between the Trump campaign and the Russians? You don't believe there was any collusion, to use that word, but you believe the Russians interfered and that it deserves further investigation, and yet that seems to be getting lost in all of this debate by both your side and the Democrats.
It is a little bit. And I've talked to Lindsey Graham, who's, of course, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, and we've talked about this, and I brought it in a letter to Chairman Nadler this past week saying, okay, the one thing we may disagree on everything else about the Mueller report, but one thing we'll agree upon is it's foreign interference in our election, and are we taking the steps need be to make sure that that doesn't happen? And frankly, we've got no response from the chairman on this. He's not really interested in that because it doesn't play to the impeachment.
Should Georgians be worried about what could happen to our elections here?
I think any election. Look, let's also not take this in a vacuum. This is not the first time Russia or any other foreign country have actually tried to influence elections here. This is something that's went on over time. So I think as the election process gets, it comes up, then, you know, and there's always the question of how do you do it and how do you conduct it. But the rise of social media has been more or less, not necessarily the actual act of voting itself, but the rise of social media, the influences of social media, big tech, in that regard, I think does deserve the information.
Well, that's my point, really.
Exactly. Is there any bipartisan legislation that you're involved in that would address this?
We're working on it in the sense that here's the concern. And I think what we're trying to do, and we're getting ready to start this, and in fact, it's an interesting conversation because we just agreed with David Cicilline, who's the subcommittee chairman, on having what we're calling tech hearings. And I mean, and discussion on how we deal with privacy, how they deal with the antitrust aspects, and then how we deal with, like really dealing with newspapers and how the ad dollars done. This is going to be an issue that we're going to have to deal with, I think, in the sense of how these social media platforms, how they regulate what they do, and it not be a political bias one way or the other. If they do, then they're getting away from that, what I'll call the safe harbor that they've had to just sort of put it out there for everybody to view. The question becomes, whether it be election process or it be just everyday events, is are they simply a billboard or the old cork board of the world where I can put my event, you'll put your event, but now is there you can put your event, but we don't like yours as well, so we're going to put your event over the top. That's why the investigations are important.
I'm sorry. So no, that's the reason I asked you about Georgians. We know that presumably this has been a red state for a long time. We know that Russians now, we know unequivocally, are targeted in social media, conservatives, Republicans, with messaging that attacked Democrats, that in many cases spread falsehoods. What would you tell Georgians about when they go on Facebook and see some harsh attack on a Democrat, that they, would you tell them to be skeptical in some case? Would you tell them they need to do more than just take that message and pass it on to their friends?
Well, I'd like to tell them to take a skeptical view of a harsh attack on a Republican as well.
Oh, sure.
It doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
You know, which party. I think what we've gotten into here is there's this becoming more and more of a belief of, you know, there, and it's a transition period. From my generation, I think we sort of talked about it, sort of, was the old Walter Cronkite, you know, generation. You know, we came on three channels at night, you got the one news, and there was not as much question. I think Vietnam started that process, but now we've gotten to the part where it becomes, what do we believe? And I heard an interesting discussion about this the other day. I was talking about fake news, and look, I'm one who believes that the media is very important to what we do. And that's why I come on shows, that's why we discuss it, because I believe people need to know. I would rather them hear from me than a Facebook ad. And so, but the question becomes is, how are we making sure that people are willing to look beyond their own opinion? And this is for members of Congress as well. I believe that it is my job to look at other people's opinion, because I don't become better in what I do. I may disagree with somebody, but I'll at least understand where they're coming from, and then maybe we can find common ground, maybe we can't, but at least I can't just simply say, I disagree with you, because I only stay in my little corner of the world and I only believe X coming from me.
Jim, let me just get a question before we have to take a break.
I understand the part about getting outside your own bubble and listening to other people, but do we have, I mean, but in St. Petersburg, Russia, you've got the Internet Research Agency.
Yes, you should
say. It's a building that is just stuffed with trolls. Now, is there anything is there any legislation, anything that the federal government can do so those trolls don't have access to our dialogue?
Well, I think that's going to become the bigger issue in how we deal with that. Because, look, one of the most interesting conversations I ever had was with Facebook itself on that very issue right there. But then you have this discussion. How much are out there are bots and these things that on your Facebook page, and if you have 1 million followers, how many of them are what we'll call true accounts or not true accounts? And then do we want the government or others in here saying, well, if they don't meet X required, we're going to make you block them or move them out? That's when we start getting into this issue of, you know, who's being censored, who's not being censored. Why does it seem like that the more liberal point of view is always coming up on the top of the Google search? Or if there's something bad about a Republican, why is it in the top, you know, three? And I've had these conversations with Sundar, who is the CEO of Google, and he says, look, algorithms are a basis of where we start, and they do reflect, I won't say the biases is what he would say, but they do reflect, you know, what they're trying to get at. The question is do we now have these super large companies that can be influenced from the outside on their own platform, which I don't think they ever thought about when they started. How do we then make sure that it's an even platform?
Let me, before we have to get to a break, let me change the subject, but we're going to end up in the same ballpark. Right now, as you know, the White House has basically advised all of its people to not comply with either requests or subpoenas to appear in front of some of the committees that are looking for them, your committee being one of them. Oversight is now looking. It looks like Elijah Cummings next week is going to hold a vote that'll eventually come to the floor eventually, I assume.
Well, not if the Democrats have their way next week. That's an interesting point. The Democrats are trying to short-circuit the actual, you know, it's always been if you have a contempt, you bring it to the floor, you vote contempt, and then it's taken over by our legislative affairs, which is a group of the leadership that then take it to the civil. It's 3-2, and that vote, Democrats would have the 3-2. What they're wanting to do now is just allow the committees just go straight to that committee and bypass the transparency part.
Thank you. So what they're going to vote on is whether to hold Wilbur Ross and the Attorney General in contempt for refusing to comply with subpoenas to come and testify about the census citizenship question. Now, we won't get into the census citizenship question right now, but do you have any concerns about whether or not you're abdicating the responsibility to be a separate, equal branch of government when the Trump administration decides we are going to essentially ignore all of the Democratic requests in Congress? It strikes me they're not just ignoring the Democratic requests. they're ignoring Congress's role as a co-equal branch of government. Does that worry you?
It worries me only to the extent of this is being under both a Trump administration and an Obama administration. I have watched under the Obama administration this slow walk of documents and it goes on all the time. I remind people all the time, there's a dance that goes on between the executive and the congressional branch. It always has. This is heightened up because of some of what we have seen through this investigation and what the president has perceived as unfair treatment and harassment, as he's called it. But what is not reported is there's not nothing coming from the administration. I mean, even in our own committee, Chairman Nadler did this, you know, a chaotic 81 letters to 81 people, and literally thousands of documents were being produced by folks that they had sent these letters to, not under subpoena. We've had others come in from on our committee on the migrant issue and the border issue. There are things happening that's just not reported. What's not coming to the committees and what is being held up on some instances is an overbroad request, a request that basically takes into things that they can't give. I'll use the prime example of Bill Barr, you know, to give information from the Mueller investigation that he legally cannot do. So it's not just as simple as that the administration is not complying. What really makes me know that the chairman also understands this is after they held Bill Barr in contempt, after we had that disastrous hearing for them, about 2 weeks ago, he writes a letter to the DOJ and says, you know, we were thinking about this. We want to have some to talk to you about getting documents.
Right.
And then they sent back and said, "You charge us with you've found contempt. Yeah. Take contempt off. We'll be happy to." So he knows he's in a bad place. He knows he's being overbroad. He's not asking properly in the way to get it. And so I think the American people, depending on which part you hear, Trump's administration is doing nothing, or the Trump administration is doing something. I think the problem is for anybody, look in the middle, find the actual solution.
All right, I got to get to a break.
No problem.
And I know we only have you for a short time after that break. So thank you, Doug Collins, Jim Galloway. When we come back, first question is yours. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
In many areas, flood insurance prices have gone up dramatically over the last decade.
Everybody would love flood insurance if they can afford it, but there's not a person I know back behind our store community that was affected by this flood that can't afford it. And they're all hardworking, good people.
That means some people hit by spring floods in the central U.S. are facing huge losses. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4 till 7 today on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much.
Beep, beep.
We're back with Congressman Doug Collins and Jim Galloway. You know, Jim, one of these we should always point out, you covered Doug Collins when he was a member of the legislature. And he was always a guy in the legislature who he worked well with the other party. Now he's in a situation where bipartisanship is a rarer and rarer breed, and yet he's found some ways to do that.
I think he sat pretty closely to Stacey Abrams.
Yeah. We sat next to each other for a long time.
Yeah.
On the committee. Yeah, we sure did.
Yeah. If we can we can talk more about Washington, right? I'm hoping.
Talk whatever. Yeah.
Okay. In the last 48 hours, we've had a development come out of the White House, DHS, that Fort Benning is being considered as a repository for some of these thousands of children that have been taken into custody at the U.S. border as their parents are seeking amnesty. Mm-hmm. What do you know about it? Is that a real proposition?
Yeah, I think what's happening is they're trying to find any solution. You've hit on something you want to talk about a real crisis at our border. It's not a crisis in this country. It's not the Mueller report.
You were just down there.
I was just down there last week at El Paso. I was down there the night 1,100 walked across the Rio Grande, about a mile from where I was staying. 1,100, that's four times larger than my high school graduating class. What we're trying to do is find a way to solve this crisis on the border, because right now we're it's just a perverse incentive to come. I put out a bill that said, let's fix Flores, which, by the way, the Obama administration wanted to fix. This was the detention piece, that 20-day piece. The asylum standard. Right now, if they come in and claim asylum, 90% will get to stay on that first credible fear. But when they, if they come back to the asylum court, 90% are rejected. So there's a problem here. We got to fix this. And then the third one is trafficking victims, which means that if an 8-year-old walks across the border and is from Guatemala, we cannot send them right back. If he was from Mexico, we could send him right back. Or Canada, we could send him right back. The Democrats have no proposal here. So I'm challenging, my challenge to the Democrats is on these kind of issues here, is put something out here. We may disagree, but it's derelict of your duty not to at least say, how would you fix our border situation? And last week we passed the Dreamer Act, which is another just green light for people to say, if you get here, it'll be okay.
This is a Democratic bill, which you spoke out very strongly against on the floor, that would provide a path to citizenship for maybe 2 million children growing up in this country.
Not just 2 to 3 million, and that's a larger number because it takes into account Dreamer. They did the Dreamer, not DACA. DACA received, we could probably solve that, and if we actually could attach some abortion care, that would probably have been a bipartisan bill. Last year, there was a bill, Steny Hoyer, sort of funny, the majority leader now, came to the floor while we were doing this debate and said there was a bill that was one vote away from being held, you know, took on the floor, and it was a bipartisan bill. And I got back up after, and I said, and he had sort of, he said, so spare me, he said this word, spare me this indignity. And I said, Mr. Leader, spare me the work. Why didn't you just bring that bill up instead of writing this bill to the left, which will never get into law? But what it did do also, there's a part there that nobody's talked about. It had TPS. These are temporary protected status. That come from events in other countries in which we'll take in people because their country is under turmoil. Hurricanes, earthquakes, war, those kind of things. Some of the ones that we just, inside that same bill was a pathway or a green card for all of those in that those areas, some of which came under TPS, like in El Salvador from 1999, I believe it was for hurricanes, earthquakes. At a certain point in time, they should have come here temporarily. We protected them, helped them, got them, and then got them back to their country. This is why our immigration system is so broke. I'm a Republican who believes DACA should be fixed. We should provide for these kids who were brought in without any of their knowledge. But in the same bill, we also rewarded the parents who brought them here.
Are Democrats in the same box that House Democrats in the same box that House Republicans were in for, have been in for so long that it's poison to reach out to the other side to work on an immigration bill?
I think a little bit it is, because here's the thing. I firmly believe that there's issues on our side, on Republican side, there's issues on Democrat side. Some saying that we got too much immigration. I don't believe that. You got some on the other side that have boxed themselves so badly in on the Democrat side that ICE is bad, that the border agents are terrible. Look, that's got to stop. Okay, they're simply doing their job. As one of the border agents looked at me last week while their own station was overrun with 900 people living there, he said, look, we're doing our job, do yours. And we've had Democrats block $4.9 billion, I think was in aid, to just get these more bed spaces. So you're having to look at Benning. You ask about Benning. They're having to look at alternatives because we can't get the aid and they run out of money to keep these folks because they're just coming across just record numbers.
You know, one of the things I hear, when whether it's you or a Democrat, whether it's the Georgia legislature, whether it's Congress, is the ever-growing bunkerization, if you want to coin a term,
and I hate that.
So that the ability to really work to solve problems becomes it feels to us as observers, as citizens, like an impossibility. And I think a great example of that is the fact that it took, 7 months to pass the emergency relief measure that would help Georgia farmers who are desperate, help those in other parts of the country who've been victims of natural disasters. And you know this as well as anybody. The American people look at that and say, what's going on?
And they have every right to be. And because I'm as frustrated as not. One, 7 months, the disaster money should have come. We should have got done. Instead of saying, while we're here, I use the old Rahm Emanuel. You never let a crisis go to waste. Well, all of a sudden, because this is off budget, we said, let's stick Puerto Rico in here. Let's stick this other stuff on here. And then all of a sudden, we had another disaster later on. We had more flooding. We had I'm in the Air Force Reserve. They were moving money from our training for this cycle. In fact, we have guys in my units who can't do some of their training because we were taking every piece of money we had to send it to Tyndall and to Offutt. This is just wrong. And it's wrong on both sides. We've got to get a point where we actually have in our budget a rainy day fund, if you would, so we know these disasters are coming instead of having to do them like we are.
This is David Perdue.
Senator Perdue.
The whole rewrite of the budget we've got to have. I mean, this is something that many of us have been saying. But let me go back to something. Yes, right now I'm in a very probably partisan position.
Yeah, you look about as partisan as it gets, and don't it, you, in judiciary? Yeah,
exactly. And, but my tenure in Congress and my tenure in the Georgia legislature was marked with bipartisan work on big bills.
Right.
I believe it is up to legislators and that we have forgotten in Washington, D.C., that our job is to legislate. Our first and foremost job is to go to D.C., look at ideas, find ideas, listen to our constituents, and look at legislation that can fix that. That doesn't mean that we leave our partisanship at the door. You take your values with you, but you find areas of commonality because at the end of the day, it's about helping people. We've got to help our country raise our gates. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to fight. That doesn't mean that we're not going to time when I think my chairman is going it wrong and you're going to see me. By the way, we did buy a popcorn machine, too, if you ever want to come up and get that. you know, we're going to have that. But I look at my career, and I've had the CLOUD Act, which is International Data Privacy that we've worked with law enforcement on. That was a huge bill we got into the omnibus spending bill last year. We did Music Modernization Act, which we talked about earlier, which is a rewrite of the Copyright Act. We did the Criminal Justice Reform, which was the speaker. Those were all bills that I worked on and passed either out of the House with minimal no votes or unanimous votes. Going back over time, we worked on trade secrets. Our state is amazing with our trade secrets and the companies that are growing here. Intellectual property. These are the kind of things that I want to be working on. Do I want to continue this path down of fighting about everything that comes on, especially from that? No. But we're also not going back up because here's the deal. The reason I wrote that letter about our parliamentary inquiry, it may seem arcane to people out there. Why can't you just say that he committed a crime? Because at the end of the day, our system functions only as good as the ones who are willing to stay within the rules and function properly.
We're still having this problem. Look, we know that President Obama at a certain point in his administration said, I can't work with Republicans in Congress. We know that President Trump has been aggressive in refusing to work with Democrats, and beyond not working with him, is insulting to them pretty regularly, and some Democrats fire right back. It's an unfortunate situation. But the problem becomes that when you or a Democratic counterpart start talking about how you want to solve a problem, I think Americans are tuned out to what you're saying and are thinking, oh, that's because he's a Republican. He wants to support the Republican agenda, and it isn't about the real issue itself. It's a terrible problem.
It is. Look, I told somebody the other day, I said, immigration at the end of the day, it will finally at some point come to it, and it may be 100 on one side vote against it, 100 vote against it on the other side, but 218 in the middle, it'll pass it. And if I'm part of that 218 with a bill that I believe actually worked, and the people of the 9th District, you know, disagree with that and want to have somebody else, fine, I'll go home and fish with my beautiful bride and we'll have a good time. But I think what we've got to do is look beyond this part and say, and look at those of us who have crossed that out. We know how to do it. And work at it. Look, for most of us on the Republican side, and still to this day, the president, if met halfway in beyond some of these investigations that have now tainted the water a great deal, when they look at that, this president was probably more willing to work with and have more ideas with Democrats than he probably did on some of our issues. Can you believe that, frankly, that Speaker Pelosi and others will not? I mean, the president himself put a $2 trillion infrastructure package and said, let's work toward this. A Democrat in any other era would have said, let's get on it. And instead, we've now had a backing away saying, well, Mr. President, show us how you're going to pay for that, which from a conservative Republican standpoint is laughable. You're having a Democrat now say you want to have to pay for the infrastructure process, but it's because they don't want to give this president a win. The president actually put, frankly, on DACA 2 years ago. You talk about putting a like shiver through Republicans who have been trying to deal with this on border security. He said, I'll give you the number that you want. Let's do it tomorrow.
But he wanted wall money, and Democrats felt.
Stephen Miller got involved, and that didn't happen.
But think about this. What's wrong with that? If you want to fix something like a DACA issue or something, say, okay, we'll legalize these paths, but we need border security for somebody who's been there, what's wrong with it? So that's called compromise. When do we lose that?
I want to make sure I understand this. On infrastructure, it was interesting to hear your take on that. I mean, it's true the leadership, the Democratic leadership in the House went to see the president. They said, yeah, let's do this infrastructure bill. Yep. My understanding is the White House said, great, let us see where we can find the money for it. Come back next week and we'll figure it out. And it was at that next meeting that presumably the president suddenly got very angry because Pelosi had made a comment that he didn't like. and walked out. So
yeah, there was no presumption. It was, I mean, President Trump said you can either legislate or you can investigate.
Yeah.
But if you want to legislate, right, you're going to have to drop the investigations.
Well, it goes both ways, doesn't it?
But in such a way, when did we start detaching humanity from a president? When did we do that? I mean, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong in the sense of everything, every president from Bush, Obama, but if you are getting ready for a meeting in which you've actually laid a proposal, whether it's fully developed or not, you need Congress to put it in development, and then you have the Speaker of the House 20 minutes before she comes to see you on national TV say that you're corrupt or that you've... That's going to dempt a reaction. That shows non-good faith. So, I mean, to simply just say that the president blew it up because of, I think there's got to be both sides here.
All right. I know you have to leave in a minute, but I want to give you a chance. If we can get to, can we get to a couple other quick issues?
No, sure.
All right. Number one, is Georgia in play in the 2020 presidential cycle?
I think it's going to be tight. I do not believe it's in play. One of the things that's often overlooked, and I talk to national reporters that come down and say Georgia's changed. It has in some areas, and I think the 6th, the 7th congressional districts reflect that. But remember, everybody at times thinks that Georgia was Mississippi or Alabama, these 70% margins for Republicans. If I'm not, and I'm pretty sure on my facts, it was in 2006, Sonny Perdue's first reelect. When he's reelect, he got about 58% statewide in a contested race. No other statewide Republican has gotten that in a contested race is that high. The closest has been 53, 54. Those were Nathan. Some of the Senate races, but they've not been, we've never went higher in a truly contested race.
Generally in 2014 and 2012, the winning margin for statewide Republicans was about 57-58%. It was no higher than 53%.
But not on the top end of that. Nathan never got 57, Deal never got 57.
So you've always seen Georgia.
So to me, it's always been closer than it's saying. I think that's the interesting issue.
Is HB 481 good for Republicans in the 2020 cycle or bad for Republicans? The bill about outlaws abortion essentially in Georgia.
I think from a conservative perspective, it's a bill that it should not have been a surprise to anyone in the state. I think it will play well in some areas. In some areas, there'll probably be some concerns about it. I think the way it is discussed and the way it's talked about, from not just simply if we focus only on the issue of abortion and is it just abortion and making our statement on life, but is it compassion about the mothers and those who are going through this and the compassion about children and adoption? How do we relay this message from a conservative value? I think that's what the Republicans are going to have to do. I didn't deal with the bill that much, but that's what I can say on
that. What are Republican chances, you think, of retaking the 6th and holding on to the 7th?
I think the 6th, there is a good chance because now Lucy McBath, who has now come to Congress, has to do something she did not have to do when she ran against Karen the first time, and that was actually have a record. Yeah. And she's now come to Congress, and she's voted, even on her singular issue of gun control, she voted against a motion to recommit that I had, that which she said, no, if an illegal alien who should never have a gun to start with, if they try to, my amendment said, well, we just need to report them to ICE. She voted against that. I think that's a little bit contradictory to what her record is. You go back into like this past week on Dreamer, she voted against in committee. She voted against amendments that would have strengthened the gang and criminal provision. So I think there's a good chance in the 6th. The 7th will be the first real fight. Now look, the 7th was closer the last time than it should have been. But Rob Woodall's campaign was not as vigorous as you're going to see this time in the Republican campaign. You're going to have well-funded Republicans in that campaign who are going to run very vigorous campaigns. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats are now going to have to deal with, do we renominate somebody who lost, or do we have a vigorous fight in ourselves? So I think we can keep the 7th. Will it be tough? Yes. I thought the 7th actually was going to be harder for us this past year than the 6th was because Karen is a veteran fighter.
And you've endorsed her again.
We did. Because we view it more from she got a half a term, and for many of us, Tom Graves, many of us is an incumbent kind of cycle. Not to discourage anyone, but we know Karen in the fight that she had, and we were invested in that. So I think it's going to be interesting to see. The 7th will be close, but do a quick deep dive. There were a lot of voters in Forsyth County. Vote actually was turned down. Even with Lieutenant Governor being on the ballot from there, we saw some decreased turnout Republican. We actually lost Rob Woodall lost two precincts in southern Forsyth County. Yep. Anybody would have said that would have been, but I think it's also a reflection of the campaign at that time, and also a reflection of the governor's campaign. And that's not going to be involved in it. Stacey Abrams had a very determined plan in these metro areas and suburban areas that worked. I don't take that away from her, but I do remind her she lost, and that is time to get over it. But no matter what her plan was, we still kept the 7th. So I think when you see that Trump voter come back out in Forsyth County, which we could actually see – There is a Trump voter in conservative districts like mine and the 7th and others, just as there was an Obama voter as well. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see how that comes out.
Final question. As you well know, some of your Republican colleagues on the other side of the building over at the Senate are cautioning the president that they very well might take a stand against the 5% tariff on Mexico, which presumably goes into place on Monday. Where are you on that?
Look, the tariffs, it's been interesting. The president mentioned that last week. It's someone coming off the border and seeing, you know, African nationals coming through, others coming through. They've been in Washington all week and coming closer to a plan on things that they could do to lower the influx coming in. And we've not even had that go into effect. Even if it goes into effect for a short amount, there's at least got them to the table to discuss something. Tariffs are not good. We don't need to be doing that. We shouldn't be leading with tariffs. But if tariffs get attention to get action on another thing without having to go forward, then I think that is a good thing. I just wish the Senate would take up stuff like border control. I wish the Senate would take up some other things as well that we're trying to work on in addition to the other things that they're not working on.
Congressman Doug Collins, it's a pleasure to have you here. I want to real quick tell you that, and Jim, you know this, one of the reasons I asked you about the bipartisanship, the lack of bipartisanship, is one of the things that we really value on Political Rewind is bringing people of differing positions together and really talking respectfully about issues and listening to each side. And that matters a lot to us here. And if we have somebody from one side on one day and somebody from the other side there, we always get pushback from our, why did you let him talk? But I appreciate the fact that you were here, and I hope you feel we gave you an opportunity to get your views across to our listeners.
Look, when someone steps foot in the political arena, they have given themselves up to say that your life is to serve people, and I believe that. And that means that some are going to disagree and some are going to agree. The problem that we have to avoid is determining that the person that you disagree with is not evil. I never thought in my life that President Obama was evil. I disagree with his policies. I would never when we get to the point where we're attaching that kind of stuff to our opponents, then it makes it easy to understand why you're mad at each other.
Yeah.
We've got to just get back to the policy and say, let my idea be one in the marketplace, and I'm willing to do that.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Doug Collins. Good luck in the wars in Washington. We're going to let the congressman go and Jim Galloway, and I'll be back in just a moment.
My name is Chuck Reese. I'm the editor of an online magazine called The Bitter Southerner. I've seen decades of misconceptions about the South from the Beverly Hillbillies on down. But in my new podcast with GPB, we're going to challenge those stereotypes and paint a very different picture of the American South. Join me for the Bitter Southerner podcast. Details are at bittersoutherner.com.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, treatment options for late-stage cancer can be limited, but new help may be on the horizon, coming from existing drugs. Plus, it's one of those mysteries of physics, the quantum leap. Have researchers managed to spot a jump in the act? Saving Schrodinger's cat on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 3 on GPB and GPBnews.org.
You know, Jim Galloway, Doug Collins said something to us during the break that I think is true. We're finding increasingly that there are elected officials who really don't want to go on shows with journalists because they just want to be able to stick to their message. And he's one of those guys like a Johnny Isaacson who is willing to get in the arena. I appreciate that.
Right. Johnny Isaacson, you can find a few Democrats. Stacey Abrams has been up until November was very accessible in that fashion. The one thing I would say that really struck me about our session with him today was that his message was actually very similar to every Democrat that I see on cable television news, which is we're about other stuff other than the Mueller report.
Yeah.
We're about stuff other than Trump. We're doing this, that, and the other, because I think there's a joint realization that on both sides that people are getting a little impatient.
Well, isn't that why Pelosi went ahead and passed this bill, which would create a pathway for citizenship for 2 million or more people?
Exactly.
Because she can then turn around and say, look, we are legislating. It'll die in the Senate, But she will be able to say we're working on other issues.
We can walk and chew gum at the same time argument.
Well, it was interesting to hear his take on a lot of this. Hey, let's turn to something that happened in Atlanta last night. Of course, I asked the congressman whether or not HB 481 was going to have much of an impact, whether he thought it was going to have much of an impact on elections here. And you heard his answer. He said in some places it will, in some places it won't, which is quite right, obviously. But last night, right here in Atlanta, most people know by now, Joe Biden took a big, big step towards changing his opinion on support for the Hyde Amendment. Let's listen to what he said to a group of Democrats gathered at a major fundraiser, and then we'll talk about it. Here's Biden.
The fact of the matter is that women's rights and women's health are under assault like we haven't seen in the last 50 years. And we've seen state after state, including Georgia, passing extreme laws in clear violation of constitutional rights protected, including Roe v. Wade. If I believe health care is a right, as I do, I can no longer support an amendment that makes that right dependent on someone's zip code.
So, Jim, of course, the Hyde Amendment has been in place for quite a while now, and what it does is it forbids federal funding to agencies that have performed abortions. And like a lot of Democrats, including some of his competitors in the presidential arena, he's voted for it, but he's been more outspoken.
He's got a Catholic identity, and he's been very true to that over a period of decades.
Yeah.
And this was a swift change. Even a day earlier, his campaign manager was on TV saying that he still endorsed the Hyde Amendment. But this is a fight that's been prompted by politics in Georgia. This is you can trace this directly to HB 481, and I thought it was just there was a nice little contrast between what Biden was forced to do yesterday on abortion, and we had Renee Unnerman, state senator from Gwinnett County. She's launching her candidacy for the 7th district to replace Rob Woodall in Congress, and she carried that bill 481 in the Senate only 3 months ago. She barely mentioned it in her debut.
Yeah, yesterday. Which was surprising. By the way, just to go back to the Hyde Amendment, just so if people aren't aware, the Hyde Amendment kicks in every time they're talking about a budget.
Every appropriations.
Because you cannot pass an appropriations measure without the Hyde Amendment kicking in. Watch out, you can't fund that agency in the budget that you want.
Right,
and that's why other Democrats who are running for president have voted for it, because they say, I got to swallow that to go along with getting the budget passed.
Yeah, every Democrat in the House this year, in the U.S. House this year, will vote to endorse the Hyde Amendment because they've got to pass the budget.
So go back to Unterman. What you just said is really fascinating, because here's state like Georgia, next door Alabama, I guess Ohio, Mississippi. All of them have decided to do something that Republicans really haven't done in a long time. Although we've passed restrictions on abortion, Nathan Deal passed a restriction,
a 20-week restriction.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was not something that the pro-choice folks wanted, but this becomes extreme to many people, and suddenly Republicans are back to saying, "Yep, we're willing to take on these hot button social issues," which we've tried to avoid for a long time in terms of
they're willing in certain contexts, but right. you now have Renee Unnerman in a Republican primary, that position won't hurt her. In a general election, it's going to be a very difficult hurdle. It's a high bar now.
Yeah, I think that's. Why do you think she avoided it yesterday? There, people were telling us a couple of weeks ago, she's going to run on this.
Yes, but you had these two DNC events in national Democratic events in Atlanta on Thursday. You had a lot of national press involved, and you know, the editors like to get two stories out of a trip. You know that. So a lot of them were concentrating on races on the 6th and the 7th, and I suspect that Unnerman didn't want to give them the pleasure.
So can we talk, changing subjects? There's an awful lot we could talk about, but you just filed a column, which is now online at AJC.com, about I think that you said it was the final bill to pass the legislature this past session. It was a Mary Margaret Oliver measure. People who listen to the show regularly know she's a regular panelist on the show. She kind of snuck something in at the wire.
This was signed on the same day. This bill was signed into law by Governor Kent on the same day as the heartbeat bill. And what it does is it will give gay and lesbian couples, parents, the non-biological parent, it will give that parent access to custody in any subsequent courtroom battle, whether it's divorce, whether there's a death involved. I don't want to say there was
subterfuge.
Thank you very much. But there was definitely subtlety, a restraint in talking about the LGBT aspect of this. It was kind of framed as a bill aimed at protecting step parents.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And the sponsor was Chuck Evstration, a Republican out of Tukula.
Yeah. So Mary Margaret was rather, I thought she sounded, when you quoted her in your piece, rather proud of herself for, without talking about it much, getting this right into law to help LGBT parents.
What she said was, transparency in the legislature is not always a top priority.
I love that. Let's go back to the presidential campaign for a minute. You had Buttigieg was here. Cory Booker, obviously Joe Biden.
Beto O'Rourke.
O'Rourke was here. And, it was interesting to me to think about the different ways in which they approach coming to Atlanta. So I thought the fact that Pete Buttigieg decided to go to Manuel's Tavern.
9 a.m.
Institution. Was it that? What time it was?
9 a.m. No, nobody goes to Manuel's at 9. Nobody's at Manuel's at 9 a.m. unless they're already there at 11 p.m. the night before.
See, I didn't realize that. But it seemed like exactly the right spot for him. Manuals, for people who don't know it, is an institution in Atlanta and has been for 60 or more years as the political gathering place for Democrats.
It has a lot of Kennedy-esque atmosphere.
Yeah, and I remember, I can think of any number of Democratic presidential mm-hmm. candidates who we've gone to see there, but it seemed like exactly the right venue for Mayor Pete, the man of the people, if it was 9 in the morning.
Right. O'Rourke, the night before, had held a kind of a little focus group with some select voters.
He was down at Krog Street Market, right? Mm-hmm. One of his locations.
Right. I think Biden's appearance was probably the most controlled. He had limited press at one fundraiser, and then his appearance during the clip where he made his abortion statement. I've got to say I didn't see any rejection of Biden among Atlanta's or Georgia Democrats. That would lead you to suspect that somebody else has got a better chance in the state.
Yes, Theron Johnson was here, and of course, our regular listeners know that Theron has been a big Democratic strategist, consultant for a long time. He's African American. He works with the African American community, and he said on the show the other day that he thinks that Biden still has the inside track on African American.
Atlanta City Councilman Faroki, who's been on the show, his was the only endorsement that I caught. He supports Buttigieg.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to watch that. I personally, I've mentioned this on, I think, our show Wednesday. And here we are both political journalists. I'm finding it hard to really focus on this Democratic. I don't know where to put my vision. I don't know what to focus on. With the field this large, I'm wondering if I'm like most people out there. I'm just waiting till September, because it's that September debate where they're going to have even tighter rules for who gets in and who doesn't. So we're going to start seeing people drop out.
I mean, these two debates that are coming up later on this month,
June,
where you'll have 10 and 10, 10 yeah. one night, 10.
So how do we pay attention to that?
Exactly.
There's no Donald Trump who is going to be the focus of attention because of the tactics that he employs, his antics and that sort of thing. I don't envy any of those people trying to get our attention on these first two debates, and it's making it hard for me to figure out what to focus on myself.
Right, right. And it's it right now, I think in the South, I think what you're seeing is this very interesting fight, especially in South Carolina, yeah, between Kamala Harris,
right,
the senator from California, and Joe Biden.
Right. And that's right. That's a place we can look very clearly. And in many ways, what happens in South Carolina between Kamala Harris and Biden, it's going to have a big impact on what happens here in Georgia.
Right. We still don't know when Georgia's primary is going to be.
Yeah. Why don't we, by the
because
way?
Because I think you've got a Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who is waiting to see how the timing might affect the Democratic field.
Yeah, but I keep hearing March 3rd.
March 3rd.
This super primary. California is going to vote on March 3rd.
California is going to.
That's going to create a really interesting dynamic to see how Democrats choose to move forward.
Especially given that California, the voting in California starts February 3rd.
Okay. We're out of time. We got a lot of time in the weeks and months ahead to talk about all of this. Jim Galloway, thanks for being here. It was really fun to talk with you, with Doug Collins. That's it for us. We're back on Monday at 2 o'clock. Wednesday at 2 o'clock, an hour with Michael Thurman, the historian. That's going to be fun. I hope you'll join us for that. Take care, everybody.